Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. And it is my pleasure to turn the program over to journalist and radio host Rose Aguilar, who will moderate this debate.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming out at lunchtime. There is so much happening on the issue of marijuana and medical marijuana, it's actually hard to keep up. So I just want to give you a little bit of the latest news to give you an idea of where we are, and then I'll introduce the guests, and it's going to be free-form Q&A. I'd love for you both to talk to each other, ask yourselves questions, because this is such an important issue. So on Election Day, citizens in Washington and Colorado voted to legalize marijuana for recreational use. And then less than 2 weeks after the election, lawmakers in five states said they plan to introduce marijuana legalization bills this year. Possessing cannabis in the state of Rhode Island is currently classified as a criminal misdemeanor, punishable by 1 year in jail and a $500 maximum fine. But starting this Monday, the possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana by an individual 18 years or older is a non-arrestable civil offense, punishable by a maximum fine of $150, but no jail time and no criminal record. There are now 10 measures at the state levels that would legalize marijuana. Yesterday, a House committee in the state of Oregon held a hearing on a bill that would allow adults to possess up to 24 ounces and grow up to 6 plants in their homes, in addition to purchasing it from regulated retail outlets. Assemblyman Joe Hogan in the state of Nevada recently introduced legislation to legalize and regulate the adult use of marijuana. Last week, Representative Diane Russell in the state of Maine introduced a bill to legalize the sale of 2.5 ounces per week to people 21 and older. And then you've got New York. A trio of tough-on-crime officials in New York City supporting decriminalization legislation in New York, the governor, Andrew Cuomo, NYPD Commissioner Ray Kelly. In 24 states, there are 40 marijuana reform bills ranging from decriminalization, medicalization, and full-on legalization. And then you've got a bill at the federal. I mean, you cannot keep up with this. Federal level, a bill by Representative Jared Polis of Colorado. Indiana's police chief has called for legalization. Illinois is expected to become the 19th state to legalize medical marijuana. Arizona recently approved its first medical marijuana collective. I mean, I could have pages of this information. So, you know, a big question with these state laws is how will the Obama administration respond? When we did a radio show about this, and the Obama administration had a high-level meeting talking about how they'll respond, and we're going to talk about that today. So I want to introduce our guests. Clint Werner is the author of Marijuana, Gateway to Health, How Cannabis Protects Us from Cancer and Alzheimer's Disease. Clint has worked in the field of preventive health for over 25 years. And thanks for coming, Clint.
Thank you for being here and being a part of this.
Kevin Sabet served as senior advisor to the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy from 2009 to 2011. He now directs the Drug Policy Institute at the University of Florida, and he is co-founder of SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, an organization that believes in an approach that neither legalizes nor demonizes marijuana. I can't wait to find out what that means. Thanks for coming, Kevin.
Sure, thank you.
So why don't you both start off by giving us an overview of where you stand on this issue. Clint, why do you support the legalization of marijuana?
Well, I got into this years ago when I was taking care of my best friend who was dying of AIDS. Well, before that, when I went to college, I tried marijuana and I enjoyed it. I tried alcohol. I didn't enjoy it so much. I ended up with a black eye when a wall came up and punched me. And the hangovers and everything. And I found marijuana was much more enjoyable, much less debilitating. And it was just something that worked better for me, and I enjoyed it. And then when my friend was seriously ill and I was nursing him, it was pretty remarkable to me what it did for him, because I would make him these really nutritious one-pot meals, and he would smoke a couple of puffs of marijuana, and then he would dig in and eat this food, which he had no desire for before. And he lived, and he lived, and he lived. And then when he had to go into the hospital for some treatment, I was scared to provide marijuana to him because I didn't want to get arrested. This was before we passed our law here. This was 91, and he wasted away. And I would sneak it to him, and sometimes he would cough, and it would come out in the bathroom, and I would be so scared the cops would come, or we'd get kicked out of, you know, he would be discharged. So it was a real terror event for me in many ways, and I felt, you know, he died, he wasted away, and he was going to die at some point, but it just seemed that it was premature because he couldn't use cannabis. And shortly thereafter, the movement started. I was part of it because of that, and I've been in it since. And what's amazing to me is from that point, there's this whole body of science that's been generated that did not exist during that time. And it really sort of kicked into gear right about the time we were trying to pass 215. And that was when the second cannabinoid receptor was found in human tissue. The first one was found in 88, and then they didn't even know, but they found there was another one. They happened to locate this. And the first was in the central nervous system primarily, and the second was in organ tissue and lymph tissue and nerve tissue to some degree. And so this whole system, this research body began to see what happens with the chemicals from marijuana, the chemicals we produce in our own bodies that work with this endocannabinoid system that had been discovered. And what the science has started saying is something that really blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. You have a lower rate of lung cancer if you're a regular marijuana user, that marijuana, the THC and the CBD both have an ability to work. Well, THC works with the receptors, and CBD works independently of the receptors, but THC also works independently of the receptors, and there's this amazing multifaceted attack of these chemicals on cancer cells. And then they continue to research it and found it's not only cancer, but it works for neuroprotection. It changes the environment of the brain that leads to the pathology that produces Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia and neurodegenerative illness like Huntington's and Parkinson's and ALS. And so this body of science was building up, and then it's continued. And what we're sort of finding is that there is a sort of base degenerative process that underlies many of these terrible illnesses. And they manifest in different ways, but it's inflammation, harmful oxidation, and immune dysfunction. And it's just remarkable to me that this plant produces molecules that are so similar to molecules we make in our own body, and that they amplify the positive health protective effects of our own inherent chemicals. And so we see lower lung cancer rates, lower head and neck cancer rates, a decrease in lymphoma, probably a decrease in colon cancer, breast cancer, other cancers that share these same sort of signaling pathways in their development. And it's actually now looking like diabetes. You long-term marijuana smokers have a significant protection from diabetes and obesity because of the immune modulation effects.
And I read your book, and this is all based on studies. It seems like most of the research is being done in other countries, right?
A lot of it is, because unfortunately it's discouraged by NIDA. They only generally provide material for research to find harm or to look at sort of the stereochemistry of these substances.
Well, and we'll talk about that later, because I think the history of this is fascinating. But do you mainly support legalization for health reasons?
I support legalization because the brutality of prohibition is untenable when you look at what this plant does. There's nothing so harmful about this plant in terms of social dangers, human health, reckless behavior, that it justifies the iron fist of the government coming into people's lives, hammering them, rupturing their lives, and either forcing them into treatment or sending them into jail. It's a huge disruption to your life, and it's a huge creator of stress. When you're arrested, you have to get a lawyer, you might lose your job, you might have your relationships wrecked because of the stress of it. It's just a mess. It's a miasma of misery.
And we'll talk about that. According to the FBI, in 2011, marijuana possession arrests totaled over 663,000, more than arrests for all violent crimes combined, and possession arrests have nearly doubled since 1980. So, Kevin, before you go over your main argument, what's your response to Clint's argument about the health effects and the benefits of marijuana.
Well, thank you, Rose. And again, I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for having me. And it's wonderful to be back in the Bay Area where I spent many years as an undergrad. So actually, we're running an organization closing down open-air drug markets that were dealing with crack and methamphetamine, as well as ecstasy, called Citizens for a Drug-Free Berkeley, which it was about as popular as the Coalition for a Wine-Free France, I'll tell you that. But I love being back, and it's such a beautiful day. So I just want to thank Bill and everybody at the club for making this happen. So I'm very happy to get right in. I mean, I'm happy to answer that first question and then get into a little bit of my thesis. I guess in terms of the health effects, I think we need to make, in this debate and discussion, we need to make some very critical distinctions and not be sloppy or lazy in our terminology and our thinking about this, because it is a complex issue. And, unfortunately, the debate in this country has become so polarized on both sides. And I'm reminded of the first day when I served in the Obama administration, and we had to heed the president's words to us, which essentially were, when we're talking about all these different battles that we were going to have to go through in policy, that we need to be able to have civil discussions and to disagree, which was healthy, but not necessarily be disagreeable in our discussions of this. And I think in this country, so many times we have had a very difficult time talking about this issue, especially marijuana, rationally, because people bring with them when the word marijuana comes up, they bring with them a whole host of emotional responses, whether it's dealing with, for example, a horrible story, Clint, that you mentioned, which I sympathize greatly about, regarding seeing your friends die, or whether you talk about other people who might have had baggage related to marijuana with back in the counterculture days. And so it's difficult to be able to talk about this in terms of the context of today's science. And so I'm hoping that we can kind of bring that spirit today. And so what I would say to Clint and really overall is that we do need to make some critical distinctions. First, I don't necessarily deny that the marijuana plant can have some of these health benefits. And I'm not here to say that the things that you saw with your own eyes were false, or some of the researchers in the audience that have worked on this are false. But we need to make a critical distinction between the components and the various, which there are over 500, in the marijuana plant, and so those individual components and smoking the drug itself and smoking the flowers. And I would make that distinction also with opium. And we don't ask people to derive the medical benefits of opium by smoking opium or injecting heroin. We are thankfully living in an era where we have a scientific process that standardizes, that characterizes, that is able to tell people what's in certain kinds of medications, and we're able to be very specific about the kinds of diseases and conditions that we're focusing on. And I think marijuana, there is much promise in marijuana as a medical application. And when people ask me, do you think marijuana can be medicine, I say yes. That doesn't mean that I think that it necessarily needs to be smoked, or that the system today in these various states is tenable. I mean, when you look at, when we've done the studies looking at the people accessing marijuana in California for medical purposes or in other states, the data is very clear that it's less than 3% of people have HIV, cancer, or glaucoma. Most of them are, it's an average, white males in their 30s and 40s who are marijuana smokers prior, who are self-reporting pain to somebody who is selling them a recommendation for $200 cash. I don't see that that is compassionate, nor do I think that somebody who has a debilitating illness, Clint, that you mentioned, should have to go to a unlicensed, quote-unquote, dispensary where they have to get around the 500-pound bouncer because of the crime that's been going on, go in and be sold, super silver haze by a 25-year-old guy with no medical experience. I don't see that is compassionate. I do think we can be compassionate and deliver the medical properties, but we should do so in a way that's scientifically responsible and appropriate. So that's the first distinction I would make. And so I'd like to now make, I've responded to the question, now I'd like to kind of make my thesis. The other distinction we need to make, which is very important when you look at policy and when you look at kind of the effects of marijuana policy in this country, is the distinction, with marijuana in the criminal justice system. So the distinction between the laws on the books. I mean, Rose, you read a prolific list of different laws that are going on. The bottom line is, in this country, since the mid to late 70s, we have had de facto marijuana decriminalization. I mean, we did the research, and it was shown that less than 1% of people serving time in state prisons are there because of marijuana only. these arrest rows that you mentioned oftentimes are incidental to many other things that are going on. And in fact, in California, you do not serve a jail time. You do not serve prison time, certainly, for small amounts of marijuana. And these arrests, we have to, again, make a distinction between in New York City. Now, they made a conscious decision about jumping subway turnstiles and window washing and marijuana, where if you were caught with marijuana, you spent 24 hours in detention while they did a background check and then they released you. And that is jail time. That's 24 hours, and that's not pleasant for anybody. But that's really the exception. In most places in this country, you're not serving jail time simply for possessing marijuana. So we should be clear about that. The other thing we should be clear about in terms of the health is that, you know, the health research from the last 20 or 30 years has actually shown so much more about marijuana's harms, especially because of the levels of THC in today's marijuana. So today's marijuana does not have the levels of THC that we saw in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. It's much higher, and in fact, some of the protective ingredients that, Clint, you and I would agree on are protective. Things like CBD, cannabidiol, which does not get you high. It's antipsychotic. CBD's actually been more or less bred out of the modern marijuana that you find on the street. You can find strands of CBD marijuana in a boutique dispensary in Napa.
And
I understand.
That's due to prohibition.
Well, let's talk about, I'm happy to talk about that. But CBD is, you know, the producers and traffickers today who are manufacturing marijuana, they don't want to manufacture marijuana that doesn't get you high. They have to accentuate the THC and reduce the CBD. So their product, now,
That's why we have dispensaries where you can get that marijuana.
Well, but that, which is fine, but the point is we need to be able to deliver this in a way that's, you know, we don't smoke any drug.
Okay, but Kevin.
So we should do that.
Here's the distinction. There's GW Pharmaceuticals. I've been to their production facility in England. Okay. They're growing marijuana. They're extracting whole cannabinoid complexes and putting it into a medicine. Okay. And that's great because that's going to be very good for physicians who want to prescribe this in a known deliverable amount for degenerative illnesses and maybe compounded with chemotherapeutic agents to protect cells from the damage of chemotherapy and to potentiate their attack on the cancer cells.
I agree.
But why should people who enjoy a plant, it makes them happy, it makes them enjoy music, it makes them enjoy interpersonal relationships, it makes eating more pleasurable, it's something people really enjoy. It enhances health on almost all levels because this whole psychosis thing really doesn't have any foundation in terms of population, what's turned up in the population. What you see with cannabis...
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
I'll just say in a minute. What you see with cannabis is smoking, even smoking. Frequent long-term marijuana smokers have up to a 37% reduction in their risk for lung cancer. Frequent marijuana smokers have up to a 63% reduction in head and neck cancer. Frequent marijuana smokers have a significant reduction in their incidence of lymphoma. Dr. Gary Wink, neurologist from Ohio State, professor, has said he started out very conservative when he started researching THC and brain cells and brain function, brain metabolism. He said, no, we don't want to be in the position of suggesting that people might be able to smoke marijuana to benefit their mental health, their brain function. That's kind of crazy. He did more research, saw what the science said. He said, you know, it's a possibility that you could smoke marijuana to protect yourself from Alzheimer's if you have a family history of it. Then, after more research and more data came in, he said, you know, I can't, you know, soft pedal this anymore. In my lab, research has shown one puff of marijuana a day is enough to protect the aging brain from Alzheimer's. He also said he told his medical students that if they have a patient who's had a severe head injury, the first thing they should instruct them to do is begin seriously smoking marijuana for 2 to 3 weeks, chronically smoking. And he has said that it's never too late to start smoking marijuana. He's not from the Spicoli Institute of Higher Learning. He's a serious scientist. And this is his... Donald Tashkin.
If I can just come in. So I think this is the problem here. This is where the debate in America has gone. This is why we don't really get anywhere because it's sort of marijuana either causes cancer or it protects us from cancer. Marijuana is either, you know, an immediate gateway to heroin or cocaine, or it's completely protective and should be encouraged. I think that that is a totally unhelpful dichotomy. And in fact, I got to say, Clint, the scientific consensus, when you look at the American Medical Association, when you look at the World Health Organization, when you look at credible scientific bodies that have looked at the, you know, the British Medical Journal, today, something from the Government of Canada, Mental Health Commission in Canada, talking about the link with psychosis and schizophrenia, since you mentioned that, which is indisputable, which doesn't mean that you're automatically going to get schizophrenia if you smoke marijuana. It means it increases your risk. Mm-hmm. So the point about legalization, though, and this is what we're talking about, the point about legalization is if the policy of legalization in America was going to be about, you know, frankly, Clint, you know, you're talking about you and your friends and others that find it pleasurable, you know, smoking marijuana without fear of the law, I really could care less. I mean, that's not a point for policy.
And the ones
what
who
I
grow
worry,
it.
Well, here's the issue. What I worry about with legalization in the United States is that we're going to have the mass commercialization of marijuana perpetuated by big business and industry that is going to constantly downplay the harms of marijuana, which is exactly what the tobacco industry did. It will target kids because that's the only way to be able to gain profits on this. Hold on, which is exactly what the tobacco and the liquor industry did. And by the way, it's going to target the most vulnerable, and that's why you have five times as many liquor outlets in poor black neighborhoods than you do in upper-class white neighborhoods. And the reason is because we target those in our society that don't have the safety net, that frankly can't write the $50,000 check to the Betty Ford Center for treatment. And I think you're completely missing the point that we know one in six kids who try today's marijuana do have an addiction to marijuana. One in 10 adults who try it. And there's this constant denial about it, which doesn't mean that everybody who tries marijuana is addicted. But if we have to be real about the science, we cannot be selective on one or two studies or my experience or my friend's experience of marijuana. That's not how science goes.
And I just want to mention for our listening audience, that's the voice of Kevin Sabet. He served as senior advisor to the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy from 2009 to 2011. He now directs the Drug Policy Institute at the University of Florida. We're also joined today by Clint Werner. He is the author of Marijuana Gateway to Health, How Cannabis Protects Us from Cancer and Alzheimer's Disease. And I'm Rose Aguilar. All right, so there's so many different things here and so many layers. I mean, you've got the health effects.
Yep.
You've got the facts that national estimates put the annual cost of marijuana arrests above $10 billion, and the majority of the people arrested are people of color. Really important to mention that.
It's also, Rose, important to mention that twice as many people are arrested for illegal drug, alcohol, today than all drugs combined, including marijuana. The idea that legalization is going to be our panacea for social justice and for helping criminal justice, it's
not there. I have to say,
when
we did our show, I mean, sure. It really is amazing. When you look at Washington and Colorado that legalized marijuana, overnight, the prosecutor said, we will not go after these people who are
thousands of lives. Let me clarify. They are. But the point is,
for
with
a
alcohol,
black guy who's 18 who has no resources, this is a big deal.
And right. And I'm not saying that. So I don't think it's a health focused for a black guy who's 18 to say we're going to forget about it, deny that marijuana has health harms, actually say it's healthy, and promote your use of this. What would be worth doing is actually having a health intervention. I agree. Not a criminal justice intervention, a health intervention, Clint.
Why do you need a health intervention
if you have
a substance?
I'm sorry,
that is
against the preponderance.
It is not. I have the facts right here, Kevin. Right. I have the facts.
I'm sure you
if
do.
You have a substance that has, if you enjoy it and you ingest it, and it has powerful anti-tumor activities, it lowers your chances for developing a variety of cancers.
It also increases your chances for other things.
It does. Look, the incidence of schizophrenia in the United States is 1%. It's been 1% since 1957 when we were a Dean Martin culture, and to 1977 when we became more of a Bob Marley culture. There's been no significant increase from the moment that marijuana.
I've got some very interesting studies. The point
you
is,
don't want to hear them, Kevin.
We've heard them. I mean,
you haven't
read
heard
your
them.
Book,
these are from 2013.
You just can't usurp all the time talking about all your studies.
Well, you're usurping it with a bit of.
Well, I actually think it's important in your.
Wait,
your,
just let me.
Go ahead.
Cannabis and Psychosis, 2013.
This was from clinical schizophrenia and related psychosis. The evidence is not sufficient to establish cause and effect. Remains elusive. Neurobiological evidence for causality remains weak. It's neither sufficient to do so alone. Does cannabis use lead to schizophrenia? Schizophrenic patients with comorbid cannabis use often show significantly better performances in neuropsychological tests than patients without cannabis use.
Wait, one more.
You don't want to hear the evidence, Kevin. You don't like marijuana, and you're unwilling to embrace the evidence that is saying that it's not the damaging, horrible drug you think it is.
When the American Psychiatric Association looks at every single study done on marijuana, when the American Medical Association and the UN World Health Organization, these are not groups that have, you know, political partisan interests. Look at the California Society for Addictive Medicine, when they endorse full legalization. When you have peer-reviewed double-blind studies
these
in the British Medical Journal,
looking at every study done,
you have the meta-analysis, it's very clear about the connection between marijuana and poor mental health outcomes. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody who smokes marijuana gets those. But you can't be selective
It does not cause schizophrenia.
I didn't say it caused it.
You're inferring that you will develop schizophrenia. A certain number of people will develop schizophrenia who use marijuana. What the evidence shows that there is a certain body of people who are drawn to marijuana because it attenuates some of the most unpleasant aspects of schizophrenic psychosis. That's why schizophrenics have a higher level of use. But there is no progression from marijuana use to schizophrenia that has elevated the incidence of schizophrenia in this nation.
So are you saying then that marijuana does not have so what are the negative effects then that you agree? I've heard on the positive
bronchitis.
Effects. Okay, so there's no connection.
And
you're
for certain
health,
small...
There's no connection to poor driving. There's no connection to adolescent addiction.
Actually, there's a study from medical marijuana states that was done by some researcher. Lee
and that
researcher
was a working paper by Daniel Reese. It's counter.
So wait. You're discounting that paper.
It showed that there was a significant drop
in traffic accident deaths because
it's a very well-known working paper that's already been debunked.
Actually, it hasn't been debunked, Kevin, because I have a letter from the researcher from this weekend. I'm sure he doesn't think it's debunked. No, actually, it's been accepted by a peer-reviewed journal.
The epidemiologic reviews.
Kevin, you're trying to debunk something, and you're saying we need peer review evidence, and I'm bringing it to you. The lead researcher for the study that you're saying has been debunked wrote me this letter.
Please let me read it, Kevin. May I please read it?
Thank you for your interest in our research. Our traffic fatality piece is actually through the review process, has been accepted for publication, and is currently in press at the Journal of Law and Economics. This is the top journal in the field of law and econ, and is a highly respected journal within economics in general. In case your audience needs further confirmation of the fact, this will be coming out at a well-respected outlet. You can cite the following journal rankings: Research, St. Louis, Fed.org, Publications Review, blah, blah, blah. So is it still
debunked? Can I respond?
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, hold on. When Epidemiologic Reviews, which is the epidemiological journal that has one issue a year that looks at the meta-analyses of various different issues in our society, looked at driving with marijuana, it was very clear that marijuana hurts motor performance, which can lead to crashes. In fact, this confirmed the British Medical Journal that looked at every single study done. The British Medical Journal looked at every single study done in the last 25 years on driving with marijuana and found their bottom line conclusion is that, Don, I don't think it is becoming of a researcher like you to say something like that to someone on stage. I have let your partner talk. If I can speak for a minute without a boo and hiss, it would be much more becoming of you and your position.
Well, you're wrong.
What I'm saying is that the British Medical Journal has said, that has looked at every single study done on this for the last 25 years as well, came to the same conclusion as Epidemiologic Reviews after doing a meta-analysis and found that if you're impaired on marijuana, it doubles your risk of car crash. But
so I just want to bring up something to
this
point.
There's plenty of studies
also
that refute that.
Those of you who are asking questions, the one I cited is a real-world event. If we can't talk over each other, that would be great, because it doesn't really help. If you can all... I can't read a lot of these cards. I know we barely write anymore because we're typing so much, but I'm sure they're great questions. But if you can try to have better handwriting, that would be great. Thank you. So the fact of the matter is, This is legal in Washington and Colorado. We have laws that are being passed across the country. We cannot keep up with them. What came across on my radio show is that this is all uncharted territory. There are a lot of these questions that we're bringing up are being answered as these states are moving along. So there are questions about what happens if you're driving and you smell it on someone. You know, what happens if a college student has it? I mean, this is all uncharted territory. So how do you see this going down as these laws are passing so quickly across and being introduced across this country?
Well, Kevin rejects the study, but this study, and it is peer-reviewed and being published in a respected journal, a meta-analysis in a sense, of data, a study of many different states.
It's not a meta-analysis.
So anyway, what we see is that there was a significant drop in traffic accident deaths in the states after they approved medical marijuana due to a displacement of alcohol use. So there's not a huge problem, obviously. There's no increase in traffic accident fatalities in real-world use. And so this is pretty good indication. If you look at cannabis cannabinoids in practice, the textbook written by one of the main spokespeople for GW Pharmaceuticals, they have concluded that there is no causal relationship in moderate marijuana use in car crashes.
That's not smoked marijuana. That was Sativex.
Personally,
which was
excuse
totally
me. No, it
product.
Wasn't. This was with cannabis. It was not Sativex.
This was smoked cannabis today that you find in the street with high THC and low CBD content.
Yeah. And in fact, so that's true. But people shouldn't be smoking marijuana, getting stoned, and driving. So we should have impairment testing. And if you are impaired and you cause an accident or something, you need to be held fully responsible within the law. But this idea that they're going to put in 5 nanogram limits, and talk about CBD, if someone is using marijuana that's THC and CBD, you can be well above the 5 nanogram limits and not be impaired because the CBD is steering the THC away from the psychoactive receptor, the CB1, and is decreasing the level of psychoactive experience.
Do you all know what he's talking about when he says cannabinoids and THC?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay,
so,
good.
So if I can, but your question rose
You're here
about,
at lunch, so I figured
yeah,
you probably
well, this
would.
Is a very well-informed crowd. Yeah. Your question rose about the real-world applicability of these laws. Obviously, we don't know yet what's going to happen. There's huge questions regarding what the federal response will be. There's huge questions about how this is going to be implemented. Washington, Colorado, we're currently undergoing this process. I would say the early indications, though, especially in Colorado, I mean, are not that pretty. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean that a money-hungry medical marijuana industry in Colorado has tried to scale every single kind of regulation that you could imagine in terms of packaging, in terms of edibles, candies, advertising to kids. These are things that in the public discussion in Colorado, we're sort of getting a taste of what legalization might be when you have these industry groups that rely on users. I mean, if they don't have people using addicted, we can argue for the terminology, but using, then they're out of business. So these groups now are what I fear. We've scaled back the tobacco industry after 80 years of hard lessons of complete deceit about them targeting kids and the vulnerable. What I fear is that we're now going to have this for marijuana. If this was about some of my friends at Berkeley wanting to, you know, smoke pot and have fun because they enjoyed it, I don't have as much of an issue, but I don't trust. Hold on. But when I look at the commercialization of American culture today, and when I see what's happening already in Colorado, we've already seen, by the way, since the day that it was passed, one stat that, Rose, I don't think you had on your notes, but that's probably the most important, is that drug testing companies who for a variety of reasons, workplace and et cetera, do drug tests, so that it's a true indication of drug use in that state. They have seen since Election Day in Colorado the rate for marijuana skyrocket in terms of positive tests. So we are, now that's early indications. We don't know if that's going to hold, but we're seeing how this is already going to play out, and the idea that it's a responsible activity limited to those 21 and over doing it in the privacy of their own homes, that this is not about trying to make money to increase addiction. From Colorado so far, I'm not
Why
encouraged.
Shouldn't your friends at Berkeley who want to smoke marijuana not be able to go to a safe, clean dispensary where the marijuana has been grown and checked by people who are with the dispensary to make sure it's not contaminated with talcum powder, ground glass?
Right.
It is not from dispensaries. We have Green Clean. Well, it is an agency. Please let me finish.
Sure.
I didn't interrupt you just now.
And it goes around and it certifies that these plants are being grown organically, safely, in accordance with proper production procedures, and are being dried and packaged. And it comes, and we have established testing labs so we can know what the levels of the cannabinoids are, so people who want to get them for whatever needs they have, whether it's stress, anxiety, or pain, which you discount, but there's serious medical evidence that what these chemicals do is reduce inflammation, which is at the root of pain, diabetes. There's a new study that just came out last year. Marijuana smokers have a significant decrease in the incidence of diabetes. Very significant. Significant decrease dose-dependent in the rate of obesity. So what I have to ask you is, if your friends want to smoke it, why can't we have an industry that's not like the tobacco industry, but that's like the wine industry? We have an incredibly wonderful wine industry here. I don't drink wine. Every red wine I've ever smelled or tasted tastes like vinegar to me. I have an aversion to it. But I don't want to have people tested and arrested and have people go in and ripping out vineyards and hauling people in and throwing them into jail because they're cultivating this product, which actually has far more deleterious effects than cannabis does. Wine, any amount of alcohol is associated with cancer risk. Cannabis reduces cancer risk. Cannabis reduces diabetes risk. Okay. This is smoking. Cannabis reduces Alzheimer's risk. So if there's a product that people enjoy, and if you add up the percentages in terms of public health costs, it's 33% of the people are at risk for cancer. An enormous number are at risk for Alzheimer's now. There's a tidal wave of dementia coming is what they call it. And there's also a huge problem with diabetes coming and the attendant problems with diabetes. There's evidence that THC is the best known substance for ameliorating the inflammation that leads to blindness in diabetes. So wait. I want to know if these are true, if this is solid scientific evidence, repeatable, established, we have a method of action for this, and we have solid, huge epidemiological data to show that this actually plays out in the population, reduced cancer rates, reduced diabetes rates, reduced Alzheimer's rates, and it brings people pleasure. And you're talking about one fraction of 1% schizophrenia for the entire population. It is a small fraction. And then you're concerned about youth. Let me tell you, I'm not, keep throwing me in jail because I want to grow my own marijuana and smoke it is not the way to keep young people from using it. The best way to keep young people from using it is for the parents to be involved in their life every day of their lives. I didn't smoke pot until I was 17, 18 when I left to go to boarding school for the summer. My parents made sure I was in Boy Scouts, I was in youth groups, and they knew who I was visiting, where I was going every day I was home. And there, and that's how you have a network of support from between parents, and you monitor your kids' actions, and you teach them. I shouldn't have to go to prison because someone has bad parenting skills.
So what I would say to that is I don't disagree, obviously, with this point about parenting and parental networks, and maybe we could bring the temperature down a little bit. When you look at in terms of youth in society today, we see that 7% of Americans smoke marijuana, 52% drink alcohol, and 27%, and it's been rising over the last 5 years, smoke tobacco cigarettes. So there is something to say about a stamp of normalization on legal versus illegal drugs when we look at prevalence.
But if it doesn't have the health care costs.
Talk, that would be good. Well, hold on. It does have health care costs. Okay. So I would go with you, Clint, on the path that THC has medicinal properties, as do other components in marijuana. Where we might part is whether those should be delivered by vaporizing or smoking the whole plant.
We've decided talked about that.
Okay. Or whether they should be not delivered.
Why shouldn't people be able to enjoy it?
Because it lowers disease risk. Because you can get those benefits, Clint, that
vaporization.
Do you want to say anything else?
Yeah, vaporization is what we're talking about. I mean, that's a way to remove it from smoking. And we don't have to go to GW Pharmaceuticals and pay 20 times.
So we don't
times.
Or we do? I thought you said you were
We
okay.
can for medicinal prescribed medicines that are compounded with chemotherapeutic agents. For people who want to enjoy marijuana as a life-enhancing experience and want to do preventive health care using marijuana, and they want to take the danger out, they can vaporize, and they're just getting the beneficial substances.
So FDA,
and they don't have to pay 20 times what they would.
I would like to get to questions from the audience, because we have some really great questions. And for our listening audience, the voice you just heard there is Clint Werner, author of Marijuana Gateway to Health, How Cannabis Protects Us from Cancer and Alzheimer's. Kevin Sabet served as senior advisor at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy from 2009 to 2011. We've got a lot of questions about, quote, legal drugs. And some people want to know, Kevin, why you oppose marijuana when so many legal drugs are really harmful. Why not protect something that calms people down and eases pain? It really makes no sense. Okay. And when you look at the ads, you know, 10 seconds of the ads is all about the side effects.
Well, I think that's a great question. So I think what our experience with legal drugs today, which cause more death, suffering, violence, and problems than all of our illegal drugs combined. I mean, you put crack cocaine in there, you put methamphetamine in there, you put heroin in there, and in terms of societal prevalence and societal harm, alcohol knocks them out of the park. Tobacco, 500,000 deaths a year. So when, as well, and a lot of harms and a lot of social costs. So when I look at those two examples of our legal drugs, that does not give me any comfort that we're able to handle any other drug. I don't care if it's marijuana, which we would disagree, I think can be harmful and can be addictive for people and can lead to mental health problems and can lead to car crashes. You disagree with that. But I would say that we do not want to use that model, which has not served us well for public health, for any other substance. Now, I would also say, and I haven't been able to say this, that the reason why someone like Patrick Kennedy and I are doing smart approaches to marijuana, you know, somebody who has fought his entire life for health care and mental health parity and the issue of mental illness, is that we both think that, you know, it doesn't make sense for individual users to spend time in jail or prison. We're actually advocating that they are not arrested so that they do not get that that arrest criminal record that can hurt them down the line in terms of getting a job or getting accessing social benefits. So we're saying we do not need those anymore, but we are saying that for a minority of the population, this can be a harmful substance, especially for youth. We need to discourage, not encourage use. Legalization are examples of alcohol and tobacco, and about the commercialization of those drugs show that we would encourage use by legalizing. So that's why we're talking about not legalizing nor demonizing.
So you brought up a few points there. Another member of the audience says, cannabis oil healed my lung cancer in 3.5 months. Because of your stand, we cannot do research and help other people with cancer. So do you favor medical marijuana?
I do, but I favor it not delivered in a smoked form or vaporized or delivered in a way that is outside actually doing the science. I mean, we need to be able to do proper studies. We need to be able to I have been advocating, you know, this is not aligned to the federal government. I have been advocating that those people with those kinds of debilitating illnesses that we're talking about really have, we need to increase the research dramatically, and we need to enroll them in these research programs today so that they can get what they need. I have no problem with that, but that is very different with these medical marijuana laws, whether it's in California or the other states, and how they've been implemented. So I'm actually pushing for compassionate use programs that would allow things like an oral mouth spray of CBD or of THC, CBD, and other cannabinoids, things to, you know, in a proper delivery system, we don't smoke or vaporize any approved drug.
Actually,
we do that in a way. Well, it actually,
it's like injection.
Well, vaporization, there was one diabetes, I think it was a diabetes drug, FDA approved vaporization, taken off the market.
Asthma
because with
drugs.
Vaporization, they could not control the heat, and they were ingesting other harmful substances. So we can ingest this in other ways. And I would say enroll those people in that program. I'm not denying the person.
Why do you
with
get
cancer.
To tell me
Hold
how
on.
I ingest
I am
it.
Not denying the person with cancer that the ability to do that. And I don't get to tell you anything. Science tells us. What
science is telling us, to the point
of the studies, can you talk about, because you wrote about this in your book, just about the history of the studies and what the U.S. government has done to quash a lot of the studies that have come out that have basically shown what we are finding in other countries?
Well, there was the National Toxicology Project, and it was a study with THC, and it dosed rats and mice orally with THC, and it was intended to show increased carcinogenesis because the government really wants to find bad stuff.
Was that smoked, or how was that?
It was oral ingested.
Okay, so.
And they dosed them up on huge amounts, and they found that the more they got, the longer they lived. Now, this study disappeared until an investigative reporter whose boyfriend worked in the government funneled it to her and then funneled it out to us. And we published it. And when the lead researcher was contacted and wanted to know why it hadn't been published in a publicly accessible paper, he couldn't figure because it had been like 4 years, and usually they come out within about 12 months. And so that was one. The more interesting aspect of it is the research that the government sponsors to find harm that instead finds benefit. And that's what happened with Donald Tashkin's group down in UCLA. They wanted to prove once and for all that smoking marijuana causes lung cancer, because the smoke in marijuana does have a similar and sometimes even more harmful profile in certain aspects than tobacco smoke. So they did this huge population study, and when they looked at the data, one of the researchers quoted, said, "We were pretty bummed," because it showed not only is there no positive association with chronic marijuana smoking with the development of lung cancer, but actually there was a reduction in people who smoked marijuana chronically long-term in their development of lung cancer. So that's the question. Why shouldn't this substance that has all these profoundly protective
Clint,
effects.
What about learning with kids? I mean, we saw
I don't think
study.
Kids should do it. Yeah. That's what I say. But you know, your approach is to keep it in this black market where it's, you know, here, there, and everywhere, and it's coming from Mexico, and you don't know if it's like, in Mexico, they grow this stuff, they put it in this hydraulic press, spray it with Pepsi, pack it in burlap, and ship it north, and it's moldy, and it's gross, and it's contaminated because they use pesticides that are intended for decorative plants that are organophosphate pesticides, which actually do cause brain damage and interrupt the cannabinoid system's activity.
You bring up a good point about it. So obviously with any policy there are harms, and so with prohibition of course there are harms, one of which is a black $15 to $30 billion, we don't really exactly know, black market that can produce substances that we would not be producing on a legal market if it was regulated. I'm not denying that, but what I don't think, though, is that legalization is the magic bullet to solve that problem. And the reason I say that is because we are undoubtedly going to have, hold on, we think we should have an age limit. So let's say it's 18 or 21. We probably will have a THC percent limit if it were legal. We wouldn't want necessarily 30 to 40%. But so for the sake of argument, let's say you wouldn't want 30% THC to be sold to people 18 and over. That means you're still going to have a black market. So we have a black market that's there, that's already so entrenched. The idea that they're going to pack up and go away, we already know that the vast majority of money Mexican cartels make are not from marijuana. So we know they're still going to be there. The idea that they're not going to be able to diversify, and if you make a 10% limit on THC, they then will be happy to sell you the 15% limit, or if you tax the heck out of it, which is a lot of people think you should tax marijuana to pay for supposedly any costs, then once you have that taxed price, you easily can have still that underground market to undercut that. So I don't necessarily think that legalization would solve that problem.
That's irrational, Kevin. That's irrational. You'll have
how
a
so?
Very,
we
because,
have a huge underground market
nobody,
for cigarettes today.
Tobacco fields are Mexican gangs growing in our national forests here like they are marijuana.
But the point is,
I mean,
we have
no,
huge
you establish an
market.
Easy, safe access to a product that's not as harmful as tobacco, it's not as harmful as alcohol, and you make it so that people can get it and they know it's safe, it's accessible,
so you think the black
it's
market
affordable,
will be gone?
And it will shrink down to a fraction of what it is. And if you have diversion from the commercial marijuana into youth, which is not what we want, but God knows, would you rather, if you had a kid and they're going to go out and get some booze, would you rather have them get bathtub hooch with lead contamination, rock gut whiskey?
Today they don't have to get it.
Yeah, because there's a market and they can get
right.
Safe.
And they easily get alcohol and they're supposed to
but
be
but would
a
you rather them
it.
Get lead
but
contaminated bootleg? Yes, it is with marijuana. It is exactly the choice. Because nobody wants their kids to have.
If you want to participate in the debate, ma'am, you should come up on stage so we could hear you. It'd be better.
If you have a kid and you don't want your kid to get marijuana or alcohol, would you rather them have alcohol that comes from a store, or would you rather have it from someone who's brewing it in a still using lead pipes that's contaminating them? Or
marijuana is so easy to grow.
Marijuana is easy to grow, but to grow good marijuana is not easy.
We have a couple questions from the audience about children. What about the kids in at-risk poor neighborhoods who will be exposed to the commercialization of marijuana once it's legalized? Marijuana use among youth in Berkeley is increasing. How can that be rectified among marijuana users? What would you say, Clint?
So we see a legal market today of alcohol. When we look at the experience with alcohol, we see 8 times as many liquor outlets in poor black neighborhoods than upper-class white neighborhoods, according to numerous studies. We see lotteries, that the lottery and gambling establishments targeting poor minorities versus actually people with more money. And in fact, remember, the lottery was supposed to save public education. That was the way it was pitched in California. Exactly. I don't think that last time I checked, that didn't happen. So we have seen things over time, whether it's the tax on alcohol was supposed to be able to have us not have a federal income tax, which is what Daniel Uchren in his Pulitzer Prize winning book reported on, whether it was the lottery that was sold to save public education, all of these kinds of things. And today, frankly, Clint, marijuana is being sold as the cure for cancer, the cure for Mexican gangs and violence and the panacea for our state budgets. And I just don't buy that argument that it can be so black and white like that. I think we need to improve policy.
You have a bias.
Focus on public health. Well, no. Focus
you hate
on
marijuana.
Health. That's not true.
It is true.
Okay, you can put words in my mouth. The point is, I look at this like a rational policy analyst. And when you look at when you do policy analysis, you weigh pros and cons. There are pros and cons of today's policies. There's no doubt about it. Rose, you mentioned some of the cons, and there are more. There are also pros and cons of alternative policy. I happen to believe that the cons of legalization outweigh the pros. You disagree,
I have a question.
In a civil manner.
So if liquor's targeting minority communities and the lottery, do we eradicate those? How do we approach those? What's the solution?
First of all, I'll tell you, we've been trying to increase the tax on alcohol, by the way, and any discussion of drug policy that doesn't talk about how we need to actually increase the tax on liquor is an inane discussion, because alcohol and other drugs are used simultaneously, complementary, and we need to discourage alcohol in society. Frankly, the use of it, at least drastically reduce it, because it does cause all the problems that it does. And actually, in Washington, we tried to increase the tax. I mean, I was in the Obama administration when we tried to do that. Good luck to us. We had absolutely no chance. I mean, the idea that we could go up against the liquor lobby, which has now grown to be this massive interest group, was a joke. I worry about, I realize a lot of people come in this with very good intentions, and I'm not questioning that, Clint. What I'm questioning, though, is in the society today, with our First Amendment, which says commercial speech is free speech, I worry that in American society and culture, we're going to create the new version of the liquor lobby or the new version of the tobacco industry, which we looked at the documents, Clint, the master settlements from 1998. We looked at those documents that they had. The level of deceit, if most Americans saw and read in their own, with their own eyes, the level of deceit by companies that have to segment markets. They said, we don't smoke the stuff. We let the poor, young, and black smoke it. That was a direct quote from an R.J. Reynolds executive. They said, we're not targeting kids to Congress. 3 days later, a memo in the late 80s said, we need to discuss our underage targeting plan so that we can get a greater share of the youth market. So I just don't think that companies in the 21st century and beyond with legal marijuana are going to act any differently.
But we responded to that, didn't we? We regulated Joe Camel out of existence.
That's right.
And we put in some restrictions. Yeah. We didn't prohibit tobacco.
But look at alcohol.
We didn't prohibit alcohol. Right. And interesting, you mentioned alcohol.
And seven times more people drink and smoke cigarettes.
I just want to cite another study. Study from Scripps showed that binge-drinking teenagers who smoked marijuana concurrently had a significant decrease in brain damage caused by the alcohol. So that's not to say that teenagers should smoke marijuana, but it's to say that it's far less harmful than alcohol.
Well, we also did, far less harmful according to different domains. Alcohol is far less harmful than crack cocaine.
Alcohol is pro-cancerous.
Because of the overall prevalence. So we have to look at the domains that we're talking about. What about IQ and learning?
Your study's been discarded.
Hold on. The most interesting study in drug abuse, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years came out of the fourth largest city of New Zealand 6 months ago, a place called Dunedin. This place looked at 1,000 people, followed them through their entire life, age 0 to 38, the last time they checked in on them. They check in on them every 8 years. What they found was that the persistent, the heavy users as kids, in other words, at least 2 to 3 times a week for at least 2 to 3 years up until age 21, that those people, by the time they were 38, even if they had abstained from 21 to 38, Rose, those people who were 38 had a 6 to 8 point average fewer IQ points than those who hadn't smoked. 6 to 8 points may not sound like a lot, but it's enough to take you from the top third to the bottom third of IQ. They re-examined that study after a Norwegian group said, well, wait a minute, did you control for socioeconomic factors? Did you control for parenting? Did you control for education attainment? Did you control for stress and traumatic child stress? They redid their entire study after that counter and came to the same conclusions. In fact, said, not only do we have it on kids, we replicated it in mice, and mice don't have socioeconomic factors.
Response here, and that's not at all what they found. They said,
you have Ole's response.
Yeah.
And they responded to that.
Has it been peer reviewed and published?
Yeah.
I've been to PubMed, and I have not seen it.
They published
it. But it's not on PubMed.
NAS. The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I mean, I'm happy to send it to you.
Olaf said that simulation of the confounding model previously reported.
It seems like you're not open to any kind of negative. I mean, I'm saying there's
I'm
pros
saying
and
that
cons.
You take a little
wait, are there negatives to learning
yes,
and memory for
yes,
kids?
Yes, and okay. That's why we need to keep Gary Wink, the neurologist who I cited about Alzheimer's protection, that the best thing known to man right now is one puff a day of marijuana to protect you from Alzheimer's. You don't even have to get high, a puff that won't get you high. His findings are that up to age 15, marijuana can significantly affect learning if it's chronic heavy use in teenagers. After 15, there's no significant effect. I personally think that if you're 18, you know, you put it at 18, you might have a little bleed back, or 21 and you decrease the bleed back to 18 and below, and that's what we do. You know, you change the, you have a completely different set of values for everything. We have alcohol, we have tobacco. Even now we have white sugar, which we've seen in energy drinks. It's really harmful for teenagers. That caffeine interrupts certain functioning of the adenosine receptors. But I don't see you going around suggesting that people who are producing coffee should have their doors
marijuana.
Kicked in,
well,
hauled
I
out.
The idea that you're comparing caffeine and cannabis,
they both affect teenage brain development to a degree.
They do, but the effects of them on society.
Well, that's what you want to believe, but the evidence isn't there.
We have a number of questions about raids, but what effect did marijuana have on Barack Obama? I mean, at least five questions about that.
Yeah,
it
ruined his ambition. It ruined his IQ.
No one is saying it's going to ruin everybody's ambition and IQ. I talked about addiction of one in six kids. That doesn't mean six out of six. I mean, obviously,
so you
want to
arrest the
people.
Other ones to protect the one. How many do we have to treat to prevent one incident of schizophrenia?
I'm saying that we need.
A lot of people have questions about raids. And after the laws, which raids, right? Last April, DEA agents hauled away computers, files, and plants from Oakland's Oaksterdam University, one of the most high-profile raids in a while. There have been more than 100 raids, primarily on California's pot dispensaries. Since 2009, the DOJ has conducted more than 170 SWAT-style raids in 9 medical marijuana states, resulting in at least 61 federal indictments. Rob Campia, executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project, said, quote, "There's no question that Obama is the worst president on medical marijuana." So what insights can you give us about, Kevin, just about where the administration stands? Because they did have very high-profile meetings and high-level meetings after these laws passed in Colorado and Washington.
A high-level meeting? What do you mean by high-level meeting?
High-profile. They said, we really need to focus on this, and they haven't really said how they're going to respond.
Oh, right, that versus that.
It was a very high-level meeting.
So there have been, obviously, the Obama administration actually has, you're right, closed down more dispensaries than we saw in the Bush administration. But the percentage obviously is a fraction of the amount of dispensaries that are in Colorado and California and a variety. So it's not, I mean, there are a lot of people that are saying, wait a minute, from a purely legal point of view, it is illegal, yet you're only going after 5%. Well, which 5%? How do you choose? What's the rationale? And that's obviously, you know, a tricky question. It's really about resources. In these raids, what I think DOJ prioritized were places that had significant evidence of selling to minors, significant evidence of selling in contradiction to state law, They had evidence, they had said in the memo that they were going to go after those evidence of where there were firearms, and not in Oaksterdam, but in many of these dispensaries that have been closed in California and in Washington State, there was evidence of that. So that was the rationale. Obviously, there's a limit on resources. In terms of where the administration is now, the administration took a position, and I would be very surprised if they reversed this position, that marijuana legalization was not in the interest of public health. That in the interest of public health was to actually have much better community-based prevention. Frankly, what we really should be talking about is how Obamacare and ACA is going to expand addiction treatment to over 25 million more people, that it's going to actually facilitate recovery and change lives in a way that no other drug law has done in the last 20 years. But we're so, unfortunately, the discussion in society right now is so laser focused on marijuana, we're not even seeing that much more significant legislation is happening to our right about ACA and Obamacare and the positive implications that will have for treatment. So it's a treatment recovery oriented strategy. And when we see groups like the National Council on Alcohol Dependence, when we see groups like AMA, when we see mental health treatment groups, when we see those groups saying, marijuana legalization, though we don't want to see people scarred for life because of an arrest, on the other hand, we don't think marijuana legalization is in the interest of public health, and so those groups are actually against it, and it's the user groups that are for it. And so we listened to both and took a health-oriented approach and went towards that way.
Walk me through this, though. So what happens? You get somebody who's once a week, maybe they're out, they're going to go see whatever the latest 3D film is, they get busted smoking a joint. A cop takes them. They still have to go to court?
Well, not necessarily. I think you could do, what we really should do is an assessment of that person's life, because oftentimes there is a
lot
more...
Why do you have to insert yourself into their life?
Hold on. Because oftentimes it's much more than just about using marijuana.
This is totalitarianism.
No,
well, if it's a middle-aged...
It's about trying to diagnose issues and problems, which you're saying don't exist with marijuana users. But in reality, there can be a lot of things going on, one of which could be... They need a job, and so it could be a referral to an economic program.
A Silicon Valley executive who does code, they write code, and he's out smoking a joint. He gets arrested.
That person's not getting arrested, and actually, they just did a study of one the chance of getting of arrest per joint smoked is about 1 in 12,000.
Go to Oklahoma.
Hold on. If you're a monthly regular user, your chance as an adult is about 3%. That was Rand, and actually two of the researchers are in favor of
legalization.
And that
3%
that came up with that
and
that
so the
figure.
Three, so, I just want to know. Sure. Okay, you go and they get referred to treatment.
Not necessarily. They don't all need treatment. I'm not saying that either.
So they get what happens to them?
There's all sorts of things you can do before treatment. That they may not need anything other than a fine.
What about someone who's growing their own weed?
They may need intervention.
What about the guy who doesn't want to be part of the black market, but he has his own little garden in his closet or in his backyard? What happens to him?
He's growing it for himself?
For his friends. He shares it with his friends. What's wrong with that? People share wine with their friends. People share all kinds of things with their friends. Liquor. They have liquor parties, daiquiri parties. Daiquiri parties cause brain damage compared to marijuana. Alcohol causes mental serious brain damage, not the kind of will-o'-the-wisp brain damage you're trying to pin down but can't yet.
I'm not trying to pin anything down. What I'm saying
is that
what happens
we
to
have,
these
we
people.
Have two,
and
we
what
have
about
two
if they refuse
left,
treatment?
And I'm so sorry we didn't get to all of your questions. We needed more time to talk about all of these issues. I want to give you both final thoughts on this. And again, you are seeing so much legislation being introduced on a regular basis across the country. So, Kevin, what are your final thoughts on the future of the legalization of marijuana?
Well, I think we're in this country on a 100-mile-per-hour freight train to legalization because it's being sold as... It's being sold as the cure for cancer, the cure for state budgets, and as many of you are saying, it's true, and the cure for Mexican violence, without having any kind of thoughtful discussion and dialogue that doesn't get so heated as to you're not able to have a civil discussion in terms of what the possible cons could be of such a policy. So I think it would behoove us as America before we go fully, both feet first into that policy, to have a rational discussion about the pros and cons of that policy. It's clear, though, that that's very difficult to have in this environment right now.
Clint, final thoughts?
Well, we're in a rarefied environment here, so it's easy to say you don't get in trouble for marijuana. In Oklahoma, it's a life sentence if you're making hashish. That means if you take buds and you put them through a silk screen, you gather up the resin.
Is there anybody serving life in Oklahoma?
There's a woman, Crow. She was sentenced to many, many years for transfer of a small amount of marijuana. Throughout this country, people are arrested and put through a brutalization process of being taken in. And when you're arrested and you're taken into custody, you are experiencing psychological brutalization. You're possibly subjected to physical violence and brutality.
We don't need to arrest.
And prison. And someone who's growing marijuana, why, you know, here's what happens if they think you're growing marijuana or you have more than a small amount. A SWAT team comes to your house. They batter in your door. They throw in a flash grenade. They shoot your pets. They throw all your belongings into the middle of your house. They trample them. They take your kids and send them off to protective services. And then they arrest you and take you downtown. And you've got to get a lawyer. You've got your whole life upended in misery and hell because you enjoy this one plant and accessing it for your either health or just pleasure that does reduce cancer risk, that does reduce diabetes risk, that does reduce Alzheimer's risk, and probably reduces a number of other illnesses risk that are inflammation, oxidation, and immune dysfunction related. So why on earth can't we have safe, reliable access to tested, known products? It makes no sense whatsoever. This decision is almost over. You're going to be like the Westboro Baptist Church at some point. You know, God hates dabs. God hates bongs. Because as more and more people learn about the science, as more and more people learn that marijuana can actually enhance their health, especially if they vaporize it, your day is done. Just want to say that Sam is like putting a little layer of frosting on a pile of manure. It's still manure.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Clint Werner is author of Marijuana Gateway to Health, How Cannabis Protects Us from Cancer and Alzheimer's Disease. Kevin Sabet served in the White House in the Office of National Drug Counsel from 2009 to 2011. He now directs the Drug Policy Institute at the University of Florida. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose. Thank you.